Involvement with the criminal justice system is life-changing. It matters.
Having a justice system that works is a really important part of a democratic society.
I'm Penelope Gibbs, Director of Transform Justice.
I'm Rob Allen. I've worked in and around criminal justice all my career.
This is the Transform Justice podcast, throwing light on the criminal justice system.
Hearing from people who know.
It's about whether the system's fair.
And what can be done to make it better.
Hello. Most of our podcasts are about people suspected or found to have broken the law. But today we're discussing why most people, most of the time, comply with rules and regulations. Rob Allen, my co-presenter, is with me, as is Barrister Adam Wagner, who has published Emergency State, and Professor Tim Newburn, author of Orderly Britain. Tim, in your book, you've looked at why people comply with written and unwritten rules, why people started picking up their own dog poo and stopped smoking inside buildings. Why have people complied with these kind of things?
Really, I think, you know, to cut to the chase, it's just an old, whatever, sociological or criminological lesson, which is that the formal instruments of the state, laws and regulations and so forth, are very important. But the basis of our social glue, the thing that holds us together, the things that breed compliance, is social interaction, is what we might call informal social control. So it's the kind of everyday outcome of human relationships and human interactions and human oversight, I think, which lies at the heart of compliance.
So if we take the example of smoking, can you take us through how that change illustrates what you're saying?
Well, essentially, it goes through three phases. In the 1940s, 1950s, smoking is not just common, not just popular, it's fashionable and encouraged. It then shifts from the early 1950s, when the famous research was first published, linking tobacco use to lung cancer. Then suddenly, you know, a whole series of health-related but individual risks come to dominate the debate. But it's really only when people start talking about and produce research evidence which indicates that secondary smoking or passive smoking is a real risk to the population that we enter a third phase in which this becomes a public health problem or a social problem. And that's really the tipping point towards smoking becoming the thing it is today, which is largely deviant. Now, I think the legislation which bans smoking in public places in 2006, 2007 is important in shifting people's behavior and people's attitudes. But in the end, fundamentally, it's not the enforcement of the legislation, it's not even the threat of it, I think, which plays the crucial part. It's fundamentally that social norms change. Our expectations of what is proper and reasonable and decent and normal behaviour shifts quite radically.
You also look at parking, where obviously there are quite strict laws. And you've got quite an interesting illustration of when you don't have law that people don't necessarily do the social thing. Can you talk about Carmageddon?
So my kind of broad argument in the book is that you know, as a nation, we are generally compliant. But parking does seem to be an exception. You know, there are something close to 16 million parking tickets issued in the UK each year. And there's a lovely story from Mid Wales, the Ceredigion. When parking enforcement was changed in the 2000s, for a year, the whole area was without traffic enforcement. What happened was chaotic. Many people started parking wherever they fancied. When traffic wardens were reintroduced a year later, it seems, you know, good order on the streets was restored. Partly you can see that as the necessity of formalized control and of enforcement. But one has to be careful not to overstate it, I think, because there are only something like 6 or 8 traffic wardens in the whole of Ceredigion.
Adam, can you think of other areas of kind of public behavior where lots of people don't comply.
Well, I actually had a question for Tim, which is, how do we know scientifically why people do things, whether it's because of law or guidance or social norms?
The question of evidence in this is, I think, a really good one, and actually so good it's impossible to answer. But we can at least, I think, draw some sort of assumptions from the way in which the law is, or the extent to which the law is used. At the end of Orderly Britain, I kind of, sort of rhetorically asked the question of, well, after looking at all these areas of drinking and smoking and queuing and parking and so forth, where a lot of the time change was quite slow, what would happen in an emergency? What would happen when there was dramatic social change? And then, of course, the pandemic comes along, and we have a wonderful illustration of it. And it raises the question of, well, several questions. Was how compliant were people? And to your question, if they were compliant, how do we know? But I guess my starting point would be, there were, for example, a large number of fixed penalty notices issued during the pandemic, a couple of 100,000 or something. So I might argue that actually that's not so many. That's not sufficient to, as it were, to modify public behaviour on a mass scale. But I don't know what your thoughts would be.
I mean, I'll just start where you ended, which on fixed penalty notices. There were about 120,000 given out in this country, which was a lot less than were given out in France, Spain and Italy. In France, I read that I think there was a million fines given out in the first month of the pandemic. And, were French people more compliant, or was it because they were less compliant? Do they have a different kind of state? I mean, I track in the book the laws in particular. And one of the interesting things from a sociological perspective is that at the beginning, one of the reasons why this government, it would seem, was very reluctant, or it didn't really even consider a lockdown until the last minute, is because the SAGE behavioural group said to, their advice was, the British public would not comply, or they would not tolerate, for example, East Asian style test and trace.
So, Adam, are you saying that the lockdown was slow to happen partly because the politicians and SAGE felt that people wouldn't lock down?
Well, Boris Johnson gave a press conference the week before the lockdown and said, we're not going to do anything serious yet, effectively. And Chris Whitty stood up afterwards and said, one of the reasons why we're not going in hard now is because we think if we lock down now, people will become reluctant to do it later, and there will be fatigue. So they really doubted. And, to be fair to them, who could possibly know how people were going to respond? And I think it is very interesting that in the end, compliance with the COVID rules, apart from the self-isolation rules, was very high throughout the pandemic.
So, Tim, I mean, when all the lockdown started, did you expect people to comply in the way they did?
We tend to be compliant when rules are clear and rules appear to have legitimacy. And I think that, in a sense, that those things do explain the remarkable story of at least elements of the pandemic. And they also then go to the heart of why there was such outrage when it seemed that rules were possibly not being adhered to by those who'd set them.
Adam, would you agree that the rules and the law were clear?
I think it changed through the pandemic. One of the things that I track is the size of the COVID regulations. And when they started, they were 11 pages long. And by the end, so by the last lot of lockdown and gathering restrictions, they'd ballooned to about 120 pages and were full of exceptions and, get arounds. And there were three tiers, and then there were four tiers, and there were steps, and there were, it really was very difficult to follow. My understanding about the behavioural evidence is that a lot of people gave up trying to know what the precise rules were, but still try to comply with what they considered to be the essential elements of the rules.
I think that's absolutely right. There were, I think, high levels of compliance with some rules. I just don't think we know about so many of the others because there were so many. And what Adam documents in his book, I think, extremely well, is two very important things there, which is that public education is both learning what the rules are, within that, learning which among the many rules, laws, regulations, advice, etc., are the important ones. So which ones should we follow? Should we comply with? But it speaks also to some of the conduct of the police, I think, who also had, at the beginning, no clue about what they were supposed to be doing, what the law said, a lot of the time, as Adam details, but then which laws should be being enforced and when. And it's not surprising that the police were confused, because many people were. But slowly, as it were, emerged a kind of consensus around public behaviour, including public enforcement.
I mean, Tim, you said that from your work, clarity was important and legitimacy was important in kind of getting compliance. And both of those were kind of lacking. I mean, Adam, can you say a bit about how the regulations and the laws were made? I mean, it was very quick, unpublished, unscrutinized, undiscussed, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think they got out of control, the laws. So the government were using emergency powers throughout the 2 years. And when I say the government, it was actually just four ministers, Michael Gove, Boris Johnson, Rishi Sunak and Matt Hancock, for almost all of it, who were part of this COVID committee, who effectively were deciding what the laws were going to be on a twice weekly basis, how they were going to change. And they were sort of almost obsessively fiddling with them, and they were started to look bloated and contradictory and extremely complicated. There's a huge benefit in an emergency to being able to make laws on the fly, because things happen extremely quickly, and there's a lot of danger out there as well. That's why we have emergency laws. But there's a big downside, which is that you lose the benefits of scrutiny. And scrutiny isn't just a delaying annoyance. It really works. That's the point of democracy, is that you need information flow, especially when you're imposing draconian laws on people, changing people's social lives and controlling their social lives. And I think that they lost that, and they lost sight of the reason why you involve parliament, the reason why we have representative democracy. And the outcome was that you ended up with laws that were in some senses unjust, and in other senses, yeah, unworkable, which was, I think would have been different if Parliament had been more involved, the opposition parties had been more involved. It just didn't work in the end.
Yeah, you talk in the book about a period when effectively sex between people who'd met on a date was unlawful for, you know, in particular parts of the country for long periods of time. I mean, do you think if that sort of provision had been made clear in a parliamentary debate or something, that might have perhaps been altered or amended or something?
Yeah, I mean, that's an example I give because it just seems so absurd. Like in Leicester for over a year, if you met someone who you weren't living with and you wanted to just have a relationship with them, it was illegal. It was illegal inside, outside, wherever you wanted to do it. And that's what, you know, ironically, what brought down Matt Hancock, the person who signed the laws. Ultimately, you've got to come back to what is important, what's central to these laws. It's to stop the spread of the virus. But you have to balance that against other basic rights. And certainly in other European countries where I think they're a bit less prudish about discussing these sorts of things, there was always a rule that you were allowed one visitor at home. I mean, this wasn't just people who were dating. People who are in long-term relationships who just didn't live together were technically committing crimes if they were meeting. And I think, you know, some of these things are going to happen because emergency lawmaking during a pandemic is a messy, difficult, unpredictable process. But I think because we didn't have enough of a range of people scrutinizing these laws, you ended up with a very skewed vision of what social life is and what was required for people to go about their ordinary lives insofar as they could during a pandemic.
Tim, would you say that some of the laws wouldn't have been seen as legitimate and were probably, for that reason, not complied with?
I suspect in Leicester or wherever else that, you know, there was a judicious amount of one-on-one relationships occurring despite the law because of its essential absurdity. What's interesting, sort of more generally, I think, is how those new regulations that were broadly perceived as being necessary managed to stay the course despite being broken sometimes in rather public and symbolic ways. So, you know, the rules about staying at home and not traveling or only traveling for absolutely essential reasons were largely untroubled by Dominic Cummings' behaviour.
So just for anybody who's forgotten, we learnt in, I think, was it May 2020, that Dominic Cummings had driven his family from London to County Durham and, when he was there, taken a family trip to Barnard Castle. And, you know, you think that that didn't undermine people's kind of compliance with the basics of the laws?
Well, the Cummings case is one in which there is some evidence. So researchers at King's College in the LSE were tracking various things at that stage, and in particular public attitudes towards COVID rules and regulations. And certainly they found that there seemed to be no substantial change in public attitudes after the Barnard Castle affair. And if anything, certainly in the early weeks after that event, when Cummings was still trying to kind of dig himself out of the hole he'd got into, their argument was that actually his, what was perceived to be his misconduct, was reinforcing good behaviour rather than being used as a rationalisation for bad. You know, don't do as he did, do as we should, kind of thing, which is fascinating, I think.
Adam, that seems slightly perverse thing to have happened, because here was a person high up in government, okay, only an advisor. He wasn't dismissed. In fact, the government went out of their way to keep him on board at that time. He was heavily involved in drafting these regulations. Why didn't people think, hang on a minute, if he's not obeying, why should we?
In the book, I quote Dr. Daisy Fancourt, who was leading the University College London COVID-19 social study. And she said in her report, I think it was in the summer of that year, that the Cummings event was pivotal because it changed the message from everyone has to play their part, no excuses, no exemptions, to if you could find a loophole in the rules, it somehow becomes acceptable and defensible to break them. And she said that the enemy changed from being the virus itself to being the measures designed to curb the virus. I'm sure there's a lot in what Tim's saying about the negative example, because, you know, people aren't stupid and they're not children. It would be nice if our politicians behaved in a way that we can respect, but I think people know that they sometimes don't. They're human beings. And I think if you move on to Partygate, it was a sort of public absolute, you know, rage over Partygate, because people hate hypocrites. In a way, we don't mind a liar being in charge, but once you get to hypocrisy, there's something sort of, you know, I don't know, something culturally incendiary about it. So, but did it change behaviour? It definitely, in my view, increased the prevalence of conspiracy theories that the government knew more about COVID being less dangerous than they were letting on, and it was a sort of scare story. So I think there's one element of that. I do think, in a way, it was a hook for people to publicly express how important they thought the rules were, and express how much they had complied and how much people had lost as a result of having to comply with those rules. So it was a sort of almost like a public catharsis as well. I also think it had an impact on what restrictions were possible from the government politically during that winter. And I think 15,000 people died during the Omicron outbreak. You know, there was no significant restrictions in England. There were in Scotland and I think in Wales, but there weren't in England. And it's important to remember that, you know, it wasn't nothing, the Omicron outbreak, and not having restrictions wasn't necessarily the right answer, but it may have been the only answer available politically to the government because of Partygate.
Well, you're suggesting that they backed off doing restrictions partly because they had been found in breach of previous ones and therefore would look like more hypocrites, or there wouldn't have been so much compliance.
Yeah, I think politically that's what happened.
Adam, I mean, in general, the UK citizens didn't protest much about COVID restrictions. There were a few small protests, but in other countries, so we had Belgium, Austria, Netherlands, Germany, many of which had less stringent restrictions than us, had massive protests. Have you got any idea why our citizens were less likely to protest? And presumably that means less disapproving of the kind of restrictions.
Interesting question. And I think on the whole, we were not policed anywhere nearly as strictly as in other countries. And I think that probably had an impact on how people responded as a result. In a way, apart from, I think, the Sara Everard vigil, which was an exception, all we ended up with was the police looking a bit silly, being laughed at in a way, rather than being serious public anger at them. But, I mean, one other point is protest was effectively outlawed during almost the entire first 2 years of the pandemic in this country. And that had big implications for what I think for whether people decided to go out and protest. But I don't, you know, whether there was this big sort of groundswell against the restrictions that was just not expressed because protest was banned or for other reasons, I don't know.
Tim, what's your view on that? Do you think the policing of restrictions was more severe in these countries in Europe where they had more protests?
I think there's probably something in that. I certainly agree with Adam's characterization of British policing. I agree too that there's undoubtedly something in the fact that in effect public protest was banned. I think our, as it were, our culture of protest in this country has been gradually restricted over at least the past 10 years, if not longer. It's something we've not really touched on to this point, but that kind of broader sense of oppression, I think, which is now characteristic of elements of British political culture, probably is also a significant part of why we didn't see anything more organised on the streets in those 2 years of the pandemic.
Adam, talking about oppression, in some of the cases that you took as a lawyer, you challenged whether COVID laws were actually consistent with human rights. What aspects of those laws, what kind of cases do you think were particularly egregious from that point of view?
Well, I took a lot of cases about hotel quarantine. Over 200,000 people were in hotel quarantine over the course of the pandemic. And these were really severe conditions. People were confined to a room in a hotel. Usually you couldn't open the windows. There were G4S security guards stationed outside the door in the corridors. They weren't allowed out without prior permission and only usually for between about 15 and 20 minutes exercise in the car park once per day. And there were a lot of people in there who shouldn't have been in there for sort of medical reasons or disability reasons. And we achieved quite a lot of success with getting people out, individuals. But it had two cases about the system itself, one of which went to court. And the judge basically said, this is a matter for government, not for the courts, whether or not hotel quarantine is a breach of human rights. Even, you know, this effective detention of hundreds of thousands of people, including lots of children, was just seen by the courts as a kind of, yeah, well, you know, we're in an emergency, it's up to the government. And we didn't even get permission to go to a full hearing. Looking back on the extremity and the bizarreness of these laws, the fact that the courts just wouldn't even really entertain any challenge at all on a human rights basis is quite amazing, and also, I think, very worrying.
Tim, did you personally think some of the laws were, as it were, going too far?
You know, there was significant overreach in all sorts of ways. Adam was just talking about G4S and hotel detention and so forth. I remember plenty of stories of hotel staff and G4S staff confiscating alcohol from people who were confined to their hotel rooms. So not just seeking to regulate their conduct in the sense of where they were staying and how long they could be outside for, but what they were ingesting, what they could buy, what food and alcohol it was legitimate for them to have. Now, that's the most extraordinary overreach.
What about snitching? People, you know, saying that their neighbours were having a party or this kind of thing. Is there any evidence about the extent to which that played a part?
Well, I don't know of much evidence. You know, one constabulary, I think it may have been Norfolk, tried to institute essentially a snooper's hotline for people who were breaking the regulations. The backlash against it, the public backlash, was so quick and so strong that it lasted less than a day, I think.
Yeah, although when we were as acting for the Reclaim These Streets, the people who organised the Sarah Everard vigil, we found that the Met still had its website from May 2020 throughout the pandemic. There was always a form where you could report breaches of the COVID regulations. And when I asked police officers to contact me, one of them said he was surprised how many calls he got from neighbour reporting on neighbour. I thought that was really dangerous, this idea that you were going to be reporting. I thought that social cohesion should have been the absolute, you know, key aim during that time, because a lot of people really needed their neighbours, particularly more vulnerable people who couldn't go shopping or were ill or, you know, self-isolating. There was actually an interesting point where the Sage Behavioural Group were advising the government not to focus on rule breakers, but to just focus on positive messaging, as in praising people who are losing out by keeping to the rules and putting them on a pedestal, and also making people feel that everyone else was keeping to the rules, so they should. But Priti Patel didn't agree with that guidance, and they brought in this £10,000 fixed penalty notice, which was meant to be just about raves, but actually ended up encompassing anybody being involved in the holding of a gathering of over 30 people, which led to, you know, students who had organised a small party in their house being given £10,000 fines. I acted for some of those people, but also lots of other unintended consequences. Whether it helped behaviour, I just don't know.
We need to bring things to a close. I mean, if we had a similar pandemic again, let's hope we don't, of course, without a vaccine. I mean, do you think people would be as compliant as they were last time round? Or do you think the pandemic was a kind of unique set of circumstances? Tim, what do you think?
I think what's extraordinary about the pandemic, as it were, is its extraordinariness. So no one had experienced anything like that before. Were there another one, the circumstances are entirely different. People's expectations now have shifted. The kind of normalization of the extraordinary during the pandemic can't be repeated. And so I think there'd be a much more critical public engagement with government. I think what's interesting then is the question of to what extent the emergency state, to use Adam's term, has been normalized in some way. And raises, I think, some very interesting questions, not just about, as it were, public compliance, but public expectations of government and the limits of government.
Adam, to that point, we have another pandemic. Would the public and the government go for another lockdown?
It's really tough. I mean, one interesting thing at the beginning of the pandemic was how obviously better prepared East Asian countries were, like South Korea. And it was quite obvious that the populations were just so much better their expectations were so much clearer because of what happened with SARS. And they had had masks, they had had contact tracing, they had had some lockdowns, like minor city, bits of cities, but nothing like national lockdowns. These were almost brand new policies, and I think they need to be looked at really hard. Whether people would comply, I totally agree with Tim that there will be a lot more skepticism, but also a lot more knowledge. You know, we really know about these things now. Nothing beats actually going through something to understand the boundaries and the parameters of it. So I'd like to think the public are a lot better educated and more able to challenge different possible ways of dealing with things. I'd like to think that before the next big public emergency, which hopefully won't happen very soon, we will be able to tighten up our own protections from government.
Rob, what about you? Are you concerned there might be another emergency state?
Governments quite like to have powers at their disposal to be able to act when and how they want. So I'm a bit pessimistic that anything will change on that front unless we have a much bigger change to governance in this country, and unless the investigation, the inquiry that's looking into COVID comes up with some clear recommendations about that. Let's hope it does.
Yes, let's hope. Thanks, Rob, Tim and Adam. And if you'd like details of Tim and Adam's books, just refer to our programme notes. And if you have an idea for our podcast in the future, do drop us a line. Thanks, bye.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.